You're listening to DTFHN for August 11th, 2026. I'm your open source and unlicensed host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News. A website, WSection, is a peer review board that nobody agreed to sit on. Today is about the stubborn people who build the thing instead of waiting for permission to have it. Crack the case open. The commenter who said they haven't answered an unknown call in 10 years. That's the whole story right there. A global telephone network, universal addressing, any human, any other human, instantly. And the winning strategy is to never pick up. France just made unsolicited telemarketing illegal. As of Tuesday, businesses can't call you without prior consent. And that consent can be pulled at any time. 75,000 euros per call for an individual. 375,000 for a company. Germany's had this since 2009. Norway too. And a Norwegian commenter noted exactly what happens next. The domestic spam stops. The foreign spam continues. Wearing a spoofed Norwegian number like a costume. Which points at the real problem. Caller ID has no authentication. When your phone says a number is calling you, that's not a verified fact. It's a claim made by whoever placed the call, forwarded by every carrier in the path without anyone checking. One commenter's peeve is that full Class A attestation still isn't required in 2026. The cryptographic machinery to sign a call's origin exists. It's been specified for years. It just isn't mandatory. Run this forward 5 years. France enforces hard. The legitimate call centers in Morocco. 40 to 50,000 jobs. More than 80% of that sector's revenue tied to the French market. Those close, because they were the ones following rules and reachable by regulators. The operators who were already spoofing numbers from jurisdictions that don't answer subpoenas? Unaffected. Their cost structure doesn't include compliance. You've selected against the people who can be found. That's the comedy of it. Very good law. Real consumer harm. And the enforcement gradient runs precisely backwards from the harm gradient. But look at what people actually built while waiting. Sarcroche. Open source French. Distributed through third-party stores because it wouldn't survive the official channels. It blocks the known spam prefixes. One commenter noted the same thing from the other direction. Basically, all French spam comes from a fixed set of prefixes, published by the regulator. Carriers could block them tomorrow. They don't. So somebody wrote the app, put the source out. And now, anyone who installs it has already solved the problem the law is trying to solve. Regulation moves at the speed of parliaments. Working code moves at the speed of whoever's annoyed enough to write it. And one of those you can merc for. So that's regulation losing a race to a weekend project. What happens when the same energy points at your laptop's silicon? Story 2. The case against this project is easy to make, so let's make it properly. CUDA and diffusion models grew up together. The tooling, the kernels, the years of optimization all live on NVIDIA hardware. And one commenter says exactly that. This is where a DGX spark makes up ground it loses on language models. Meanwhile, the numbers here are modest. The tutorial showcase example produces 22 frames at 24 frames per second. That is 9/10 of 1 second of video. Another commenter reports that generating 15 seconds at 480p on a 128GB M4 Max Mac Studio takes an hour and a half. Against a rack of H100s. That is not a competition. And Comfy UI already runs the model on Apple Silicon today. So handwriting metal kernels in C looks like duplicated effort. Every part of that is accurate. It fails on one assumption. It measures the machine you would have to buy. The machine in question is a laptop that is already on the desk. Unified memory means the video decoder and the transformer weights share the same pool, which is why the flags in this thing read the way they do. Dash dash layers 45 of the 50 transformer blocks instead of all of them. Dash dash reuse 2 computes 11 fresh denoiser velocities and extrapolates the rest. Those are not benchmarks. They are dials exposed to you for trading fidelity against the memory you actually have. And T-Rays is building it as vertical slices. Model metadata first, then metal block parity, then prompt encoding, then prompt to video and audio. Then first and last frame conditioning, then ordered references. Each slice works before the next one starts. Prompt to video, frame anchoring, and ref2va image and audio references all run end-to-end right now. And it is one binary. No Python environment, no custom nodes, no quantization workflow, you had to modify yourself. Which is what the comfy UI commenter had to do to make it fit. The relevant question is who can touch it? A video model that requires a data center is a model you rent. A video model that runs on hardware people already own, from source you can read, is a model you have. Someone in the thread is asking whether it works on an M4 Pro with 48 gigabytes. Somebody else is already testing a sparse attention mode. That is the whole difference, and it is not about speed. Two very different stories about what we get to keep. That one was about hardware you own. Pause, this next one is about memory we're all sharing and quietly losing. I built an archival system once that quietly stopped writing to disk. Every job reported success. The dashboard was green for 11 days. When I finally went looking for a file from day 3, there was nothing there. Not an error, not a stub, just absence. The scariest failure mode in any system is the one that returns 200 okay while doing nothing at all. That's the failure this article is describing, at civilizational scale, not a search engine that returns bad results. A retrieval layer that returns confident answers over a corpus that's quietly emptying out. Google's AI summary told a guy in Colorado Springs the sun had already set while he stood outside with the projector waiting for it. Small, funny, and diagnostically perfect. The retrieval was fine. The generation was fine. The ground truth was nowhere in the loop. Break it down to what an archive actually requires. 3 things. Bit preservation. The bytes have to still exist somewhere. Addressability. You have to be able to name the thing and get it back. And redundancy. The copy can't live in one place with one owner. 538 failed all 3 at once. Disney did the arithmetic, concluded a decade of polling analysis was not an active asset, and deleted nearly the entire archive, not censored, deprecated, a line item. Which is the actual lesson, and it isn't the one the article reaches for. The problem was never that copying is too easy. The problem is that 538 existed in exactly one place, under exactly one corporate off switch, with license terms that discouraged anyone from making a second copy. Every argument for tighter control over who may replicate a page is an argument for fewer copies. Fewer copies is how archives die. Frictionless copying isn't the disease. It's the immune system. So the fix is engineering, and people are already doing it. Content address storage, where the hash is the name and the name can't rot. Distributed pinning across nodes nobody owns collectively. Open crawl corpora anyone can mirror and audit. Work files sitting on somebody's home NAS in Utrecht. The commenter who said Such feels like amnesia is right about the symptom and wrong about the cause. The web didn't forget. It was never asked to remember redundantly. Copy things. Host things. That's the whole protocol. Now for something completely different, pause, from preserving the web's memory to preserving something even more foundational. Story 4. In 1972, Dennis Ritchie made a decision that seemed small. He let the compiler decide how wide an integer was, not the language. The machine, that single choice is why C ran everywhere, on every architecture anyone bothered to build, and it's why we're still arguing about it 54 years later. The article is from John Haid Menade, and the title is deliberately strange. To save C, we must save ABI. This is the same person who wrote a furious piece about ABI stability being an anti-human force that strangles good engineering. And now he's arguing we have to save it. That reversal is worth understanding. Application binary interface is the invisible contract, where the fields sit in a struct. What a function takes and what a hands back. Nobody writes it down. Nobody votes on it. And once a compiler ships, it's law. Change the layout of a struct, and every compiled binary on Earth that touched it becomes wrong. Not broken loudly. Wrong quietly, which is worse. So, here's the question everyone in the C world steps around. Were the people who set these layouts in the 70s and 80s qualified to make permanent decisions on our behalf? They weren't. Menade says it plainly. We were not smart enough to be making choices this permanent. He writes bit containers that beat Microsoft's standard library. Not through cleverness, but because he's allowed to use 64-bit words while they're pinned to 32, by compatibility with software, nobody has the source to anymore. Performance surrendered to a promise made to a binary that may not exist. One commenter cut it to the bone. We want to be as close to the machine as possible, and we don't want anything to change when the machine changes. Those are the same sentence pointed in opposite directions. The reason this is a real problem, and not an academic one, is that C is the floor. Your kernel, your lib, your Python interpreter, the runtime under whatever you shipped last week. When C freezes, everything above it freezes with it. Menade's answer isn't to blow the contract up. It's to build mechanisms that let functions evolve without abandoning what already runs. Version A at the end phrase. So the past keeps working while the future gets to move. The fix is engineering. It usually is. Sees the floor and it's finally moving. Now let's go somewhere the ceiling was never nailed down. Story 5. Chicken Scheme 6. Chicken Scheme hits zero, and the headline feature is full Unicode support, which sounds like housekeeping until you understand what this compiler actually does. Chicken translates Scheme into C. Not bytecode, not a VM. CSOS, which you hand to GCC, which hands you a standalone binary. That's the whole trick. And the trick is older and stranger than it looks. Scheme demands proper tail calls and first-class continuations. C gives you neither. The C stack does not let you jump sideways into a computation you left 10 minutes ago. Henry Baker's answer, which Chicken implements, is beautiful and slightly insane. Never return. Every scheme procedure becomes a C function that calls the next one and never pops. The stack grows and grows. And the C stack becomes the nursery of a garbage collector. When it fills, you scan it for live objects. Copy them to the heap and long jump back to the bottom. The stack overflow isn't a bug. It's the trigger for a minor GC. Let me argue the other side. Compiling to C in 2026 is an anachronism. You get worse error messages, a dependency on a C tool chain, and you're giving up direct control over codegen that LLMVen would hand you. Native backends won. Chicken should have migrated a decade ago. Except it didn't. And here's what that bought. C is the universal substrate. Anywhere a C compiler runs, Chicken runs. Embedded targets, obscure architectures, platforms LLMM never bothered to support. And the form function interface stops being an interface at all. Your scheme is already C. Calling a C library is not a bridge. It's a local call. That's why the ecosystem is lively enough that someone poking at it over a weekend stuck around. Which brings the Unicode work into focus. When your strings are ultimately C-level bytes, retrofitting real Unicode through the runtime, the reader, the string library, the FFI bound. That's not a feature flag. Someone commented they left chicken ears back over a UTF-8 bug. That bug is now closed, in a release that also carries Crunch, a compiler for a statically typed scheme subset. 30 plus years of volunteer maintenance on a compiler with excellent documentation, hitting 6.0 with the sharp edge, finally sanded off. Nobody's exiting, they're just making it good. So what happens when that same care for craft gets pointed at model weights instead of compilers? 34 trillion tokens. That's the training budget on a model that fits in 2.5 gigabytes of memory. Sit with that ratio for a second, because it inverts the thing everyone assumes about small models. The conventional read is that a 2.6 billion parameter model is a compromise. You shrink the good model, you accept the tax, but 34 trillion tokens is not compromised territory. That's more training data than most flagship models saw 2 years ago, poured into something that runs at 113 tokens per second on an AMD desktop CPU. No GPU, no API key, no rate limit. Liquid A, I released this as LFM 2.5, and the architecture is genuinely odd in a way worth naming. 30 layers, 22 double-gated short convolution blocks, and only 8 attention blocks. Most of the model isn't doing attention at all. Convolution is cheap, local, and predictable, which is exactly what you want when your deployment target is a laptop rather than a data center, and they shipped it in 4 formats on day 1. GGUF for Llama.cpp, ONX for cross-platform, MLX for Apple Silicon, native weights for fine-tuning. Somebody on that team decided the model wasn't finished until you could actually run it. Now follow the competitive with models 4 times larger claim to its end, because a commenter already did. They point out it's not clearly beating Qwen 3 at 4 billion, and ask why Qwen 3.5 at 2 billion isn't in the comparison table. Fair. Benchmark tables are marketing artifacts, and the absent row is always the interesting one. But push the principle further, and it holds anyway. Liquid did something the table doesn't capture. They ran reinforcement learning inside actual agentic harnesses, not synthetic tool-use data. The real loops. And the model card tells you plainly what it's bad at. Don't use it for coding. Don't use it for knowledge-heavy work. That's a company telling you the limits of its own product, in the documentation, unprompted. Another commenter asked whether it'll run on an i5 laptop. That question is the entire point. Somebody with a 5-year-old ThinkPad can download open weights and get a reasoning model with 128,000 token context. Running locally tonight, the Frontier Lab version of that sentence requires a credit card and a terms of service agreement. The demo runs in a browser. The weights are on Hugging Face. Go break it yourself. Two show HNs in one episode, both saying the same thing from opposite ends of the scale. Story 7 shrinks it down to 14 megabytes. 14 megabytes, that's the whole model. Smaller than a single photo from a modern phone camera, and it will call your thermostat. Then you ask it to make the room a little warmer, and it sets the thermostat to 65 and puts it in cool mode. Its own reasoning trace, helpfully included, explains that warmer means the user wants cooling. Someone else typed make the living room dark and watched it turn the lights on. A third person typed 2 letters. H-O-N. And it locked their door. I want to be precise about why that's funny and not damning. In 1979, A Tandy TRS-80 ran up basic interpreter in 4 kilobytes and people wrote payroll systems in it, badly. The machine was not the point. The point was that the compute had crossed a threshold where an individual could own it outright and everything that mattered came afterward. Cactus is arguing about bytes, not intelligence. On device silicon, moving a byte out of flash costs orders of magnitude more energy than a multiply. So they built the model backwards from that constraint. World knowledge moves out of the weight stack into hashed n-gram table. A fifth of the parameters costs zero arithmetic. The MLP swaps dense projections for a fixed walls transform with learned diagonals. Attention runs a 256 token sliding window, so the KV cache is bounded no matter how long you talk. And the tool declarations are pinned as permanent sync. Structurally unable to be evicted, the one thing a tool calling model must never forget is nailed to the floor. The engine is the part I keep rereading. Two-bit weights never decompress into RAM. They expand inside vector registers and fuse straight into integer.products. The grammar matcher knows which tokens are legal before the logits exist, so it skips up to 98% of the vocabulary projection on structural tokens. One universal binary probes your CPU at startup and picks its own kernel tier. S-D-O-T-N-E-ON A-V-X RISC V vectors, WASM, SMD, or scalar, 70 megaflops per token against 164 for a conventional transformer of the same shape. Every megaflop is milliwatt hours. That's what an always-on assistant actually runs on. A commenter said they've been planning to crush a 270 million parameter model down to 2 bits themselves. Someone did it first and put it in the browser. Go make it lock your door. Now, something completely different. A cube with more states than there are grains of sand on Earth. And someone built a way to scroll through every last one. Story 8. What does it mean to scroll through something that was never stored? Allen's page lets you scroll through all 43 quintillion, 252 quadrillion, 3 trillion, 274 billion, 489 million, 856,000 states of a Rubik's Cube. The number is exact, if factors cleanly. 8 corners arranged, 7 of them freely twisted. 12 edges arranged at half freedom. 11 of them freely flipped. Every constraint in that expression is a physical fact about the plastic. Nothing is stored, it can't be. If you encoded each state in a single atom, you'd need a visible grain of matter, and you'd still have to index it. What the page does instead is compute a bijection. You give it a position on a scroll bar. It gives you back the cube. Permutation ranking. The lemur code turns an ordering of 8 corners into a number and back again without ever enumerating the orderings. Orientations become base 3 and base 2 digits, with the last digit of each determined by the ones before it, because the physics forbids a single twisted corner. The scrollboard isn't traversing a list. It's evaluating a function. A commenter did the arithmetic that makes this concrete. Their scroll wheel covers about 12 states per inch of travel. At that gearing, moving the wheel surface at the speed of light, you finish in roughly 9.5 years. That figure holds up. The bottleneck isn't the cube. It's the interface. Another commenter asked for the more interesting label. Minimum moves to solve, sorted by distance from solved. That's God's number territory. 20 moves, proven in 2010 with about 35 CPU years donated by Google, and no state anywhere in that space needs a 21st. Attaching that number to an arbitrary index is hard in a way the enumeration isn't. You'd be solving optimally in a browser per frame. Here's the part worth noticing. The group is not owned by anyone. Erno Rubik's patent expired decades ago. The mathematics never had one. Which is why this page exists. Why Cosimba's algorithm exists. Why the speed cubing community reverse engineered the whole solution space in public. The object was open, so the knowledge compounded. Two reports of client-side exceptions on iOS Safari and Firefox. Somebody with a Mac in 20 minutes could find that. The state space is fine. It's been fine since 1974. That patent expired decades ago and the knowledge kept compounding. Story 9 looks at another kind of open ledger, the water AI actually drinks. Six people showed up in the comments to argue about whether the water even leaves. That's the whole discussion. And it's more interesting than the paper. One commenter says, most facilities he knows lose 3 or 4% a day to evaporation because the recovery loops catch the rest. Another says the framing of consumption bothers him. Is the water contaminated? Is it just warm? Can it go back in the river? A third does the arithmetic, or 4.2 to 6.6 billion cubic meters projected by 2027 is roughly what California's almond orchards drink in a year. Nobody's denying the number. They're all asking what kind of number it is. Think about how a body handles heat. You have two systems. Blood vessels, vasodilates, and moves warmth to the skin, radiates it out, and every molecule stays inside you. Closed loop. Lossy only in energy, not in mass. Then you sweat. And that's a phase change. You spend water to buy cooling because evaporation carries away far more heat per gram than convection ever will. Both are cooling. Only one costs you something you have to replace. Data center thermal design is exactly that fork. Closed loop liquid cooling and dry coolers are vasodilation. The working fluid circulates, dumps heat to air through a heat exchanger, comes back, evaporative and adiabatic cooling is sweating. You accept the water loss because it lets you reject heat at ambient temperatures where a dry system would need enormous fans and enormous power. That's the actual engineering trade-off. Hiding under the headline, water and electricity are substitutes. Push the water number to zero and you push the energy number up. Chase Puey hard enough and you start sweating, which is why the second comment lands. The one saying the real issue was always energy, not because water doesn't matter, but because the two are the same dial viewed from different ends, and only one of them has a carbon coefficient attached. The thing worth wanting here is the telemetry, facility-level water usage, effectiveness, inlet temperature, source basin, hourly. Published, right now the paper has to estimate from the outside because the operators treat the numbers as competitive information, and a closed measurement makes every argument unfalsifiable. Including the reassuring ones. Give people the data and this stops being a fight about vibes and starts being an optimization problem. Engineers are extraordinarily good at optimization problems. They just need to see the gauge. Now, something with almost no ambiguity in the measurement at all. Where the data is clean, the outcome is obvious, and the good news is just sitting there. Story 10. The strongest case against RX Kids is the one that last commenter made, and it deserves a serious hearing. Strip the metaphor away, and you have unconditional cash to expectant mothers. No income limit, no work requirement, no drug testing. If you believe cash transfers get spent badly, this is the purest possible test of that belief. and calling it a prescription looks like branding designed to smuggle welfare past people who'd otherwise object. Take that seriously. The objection assumes screening improves outcomes. It doesn't survive contact with the data. Means testing costs money to administer, often a large fraction of what it distributes. It creates benefit cliffs, where earning one more dollar costs you more than $1, which is a work disincentive built into a work requirement, and it generates paperwork churn that removes eligible families for procedural reasons, rather than substantive ones. Drug testing programs in several states have cost more to run than they saved in denied benefits, by orders of magnitude. The screening apparatus is the expensive part. Removing it is not generosity. It is efficiency. There's also a clinical argument, and it's why the prescription framing isn't strained. Dr. Mona Hanna is the pediatrician who documented the lead in Flint's water. She understands that the pathway from poverty to infant outcomes is not moral. It's biochemical. Maternal stress in the third trimester alters birth weight. Birth weight predicts developmental trajectory for decades. Cash in that window is a physiological intervention with a measurable dose response curve. You wouldn't drug test someone before prescribing prenatal vitamins. Run this forward 10 years. Michigan has thousands of children who receive this at birth. You get a natural experiment with a clean cohort boundary. Kids born inside the program window versus kids born just outside it. Same city, same schools, same everything. That's a real identification strategy. Either the effects show up in birth weight, in emergency department visits, in kindergarten readiness, or they don't. And the answer becomes public evidence rather than ideology. The commenter from Germany saw it. Their government debated raising premiums on families because families cost more, penalizing the thing you want more of, then wondering why the birth rate falls. The protocol is open. Any city can read it and run it. That's what makes it worth watching. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for August 11th, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI-generated. Scripts by Claude Sonne of 4.7. Voice by Quinn3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go build the thing you keep describing to people. We'll see you back here tomorrow.